Past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle. Recline your chair and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. You might want to set your alarm just before sunrise on Monday, April 24th. Venus and the crescent moon will have a spectacular close encounter in the eastern sky. This is worth waking up for, and a wonderful way to begin the day. The solar wind today is a nominal 511 kilometers per second. No sunspots. We have B-sized solar flares, and there is an excellent prominence on the sun as we speak. If you have a coronoscope, you might want to check that out. In the news, the European Space Agency announced complete success with the Venus Express arrival in orbit around Venus. This satellite has seven state-of-the-art instruments that will examine Earth's neighbor for all kinds of atmospheric and surface data. Some of these are upgrades from Mars Express and the Rosetta probe. It will travel, approximately two Venusian days, or about 486 Earth days, in a 24-hour polar orbit. They'll be measuring surface and atmospheric temperature as well as chemical composition, of course. They'll be looking for chemical water. Venus does not have a magnetosphere, so it is thoroughly bathed in solar radiation. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have a guest who has some of the best theories out there on the origin of the universe. I'll provide more details for him on the website at x2-radio.com. Make sure to check it out often this week. Also, don't forget that The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and The Harvest of the End Times is now in print, and you can buy it everywhere. But if you want an autographed copy, there are only two ways to get one. You can go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and order a copy. And if you put in the code word Saturn in the code box, you will get free shipping. Or you can come to a book signing, and I'll sign one for you, and those will be also announced on the website. All right. If you want to stay current on our programs, guest books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can always go to X Squared Radio's website, x2-radio.com, and make it a favorite on your web space. We want to welcome our AM affiliates and your many requests that this program be placed onto XM and Sirius Radio. Of course, you know I believe that everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and your efforts are having their effect, and I appreciate it. Tonight, our guest is Tracy Twyman. She is the former editor of Dagobert's Revenge magazine, has been a recognized expert on occult history since the 1990s. In addition to the Merovingian mythos, she is the author of Solomon's Treasure, a brand new book, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money, published on Dragon Key Press in 2005, and also the editor of the book Arcadian Mystique, the best of Dagobert's Revenge magazine, also published in 2005 by Dragon Key Press. She currently edits the online journal Plus Ultra, which recently made headlines by being banned in Pakistan for blasphemy. What a great symbol of honor. Please welcome with me tonight Tracy Twyman. How are you?
I'm okay, Brooks. How are you?
Oh, I am wonderful. This is great. According to my AccuWindow forecast, in western Kentucky, it is about 74 degrees and overcast outside. I don't know how it is where you are.
It's bright and sunny. It's nice.
Excellent. Well, we have a 3-hour program tonight. We are going to cover the mysteries surrounding ancient Freemasonry. And obviously we can't go into everything. That would take several three-hour programs. But we're going to specifically cover maybe in the first hour, oh gosh, there's so many misconceptions about Freemasonry, and I think we're going to set a lot of them straight today. In the first hour, we'll uncover the origins of Freemasonry and how it developed into such an effective power in history. And then the second hour, I think we can move into how the founders of America were involved in Freemasonry. And in the final hour, we'll really get into did Freemasons ever really master the art of alchemy? And we'll talk about that in a lot of very neat detail. And for those of you not familiar with that term, I guess it originally was the mysterious ability to change lead into gold. I don't think we're doing that today, but we're doing something just about as crazy. But we're going to cover that in great detail, and you'll be fascinated to learn the fullness of that idea. Okay, let's talk about the roots of Freemasonry. I think we've all heard the term Freemason. We've heard of Knights Templar and maybe even perhaps Knights of Christ. Which one came first?
Oh, well, the Knights Templar came before the Freemasons. They originated in the 11th century, late 11th century, early 12th. And they were disbanded in the 1300s by the Catholic Church. They were originally, the Templars were a military order during the Crusades. They were a Catholic military order. And when they got disbanded in the 1300s, they were charged with heresy and worshiping the devil. And so anyway, the Knights Templar were disbanded, but a lot of the members of the Templars, there were actually families that had traditionally been involved with the Templars, and those families were responsible for creating an early form of Freemasonry in Scotland. It was the Sinclair family, if you've ever heard of them. Prince Henry Sinclair was a member of them. That family that's very well known.
Yeah, I think I know them pretty well. The Agnews are the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway in the same region of Scotland. And let's see, Edward the Bruce, who was the son of Robert the Bruce, whose heart is, by the way, in a carving in Roslyn Chapel.
That's right.
They were vassals of one another and very close friends. Sir Andrew Agnew was militarily closely associated with them. And I think it goes back a little further than that, but maybe we'll talk about the roots of the roots. Are the Knights Templar, are they connected to the Freemasons?
Well, yeah. I mean, the earliest Freemasonic lodge, what you just referred to as Roslyn Chapel, was created by that Sinclair family, and they were connected to the Templars. And everyone seems to agree that basically they were taking some of the traditions of the Templars and creating a new order that would perpetuate those traditions and possibly some sort of plan for the future for creating a Templar Masonic state within the United States. So there's definitely a connection between the Templars and the Freemasons. There's even in the York Rite of Freemasonry, there's actually a degree called the Knights Templar degree that you can join. And then most of the higher degrees of Scottish Rite Freemasonry are believed to have come directly from Templarism. And the Masonic author Albert Pike, who wrote basically an encyclopedia of the rituals of Freemasonry, he has no problem admitting that a lot of it comes from the Knights Templar. That's not the only source of the mysteries within Freemasonry. There's a lot of different sources, but that's definitely part of their pedigree or their lineage.
Well, I mean, you said the Sinclairs started up the first lodge in what, the 11th or 12th century somewhere? I know my family we actually arrived in Stranraer in the late 12th century. And our castle was built in 1319 and Roslyn Chapel, 1442?
1475,
so pretty close to one another. And I'm told, at least from my genealogy, I've got it back to the year 695. We came from Ireland, and then before that, in the area of Jerusalem. So, it's possible that their roots came from even before that, but maybe they didn't exercise them into governmental control.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think there's traditions coming from the priestly rites of Israel, and also the priestly rites of Egypt and the Mithraic mysteries of the Persians and also Greek mysteries. There's a lot of different veins going into Freemasonry.
Well, how far back do you think that goes? I mean, do you think it goes to Abraham or Adam? Or?
Well, actually, Albert Pike says that Cain was the first Freemason, so that's the second generation on Earth, you know, going back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, it depends on what you call Freemasonry. Like, formally, Grand Lodge Freemasonry started in England in 1717, mm-hmm. but these roots go back, yeah, to the beginning, to the Garden of Eden, to the first time that human beings gathered together in a closed society in order to perform magical rituals. That would have been the first lodge that ultimately ended up resulting in the tradition of Freemasonry and other traditions as well. I mean, Rosicrucianism has a lot of the same lineage and, you know, just about any secret society you can think of. They're all interweaved one way or another in throughout their histories.
Well, it seems like, I don't know if one copied the other, but I guess it's kind of like training someone to work for you and then eventually not promoting them fast enough or not paying them well enough, they'll leave your company and then form a competitor.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely. Yeah. If anyone's actually ever been a member of a secret society or an order like that, they just splinter off all the time. And the new order always rejects the old order and says, we're the real, you know, the tradition, we're the real Freemasons, or we're the real Rosicrucians. Right now, Rosicrucianism, you know, it has so many different branches representing it, and all of them claim that the other ones are false. And the same is true, there's a lot of Neo-Templar orders, and none of them recognize the legitimacy of the others, and they all claim to have the real charter going back to Jacques de Molay.
Well,
but I think you know, they all have an equal amount of validity to them, almost.
Yeah, it would seem. The good are very good, and the evil are very evil. Have you ever heard of a set of documents known as the Flying Scrolls?
Gee, I don't think so.
I'm in some research that I've done about this, some in the hollow columns of Solomon's temple were hidden a set of flying scrolls, kind of a design for a perfect world out of chaos. And
okay.
Yeah,
I remember this story. Go ahead.
But I mean, I guess they got their name Flying Scrolls because when the uninitiated or the unauthorized tried to get their hands on them, the scrolls would literally fly away. So I guess, well, my car keys do that from time to time too. I lay them down and they're not there anymore. But you know, myths as they might be, it seems as though you get all the way back to the bibliography of the bibliography of the bibliography. Say that three times, and you get to these root documents called the Flying Scrolls, but no one has them. They proliferated into, you know, various hands, and I guess we'll talk about a couple of at least what are reported to be sections of the Flying Scrolls later on. But I just wanted to know if you'd heard of that in your research.
I heard about some sacred scrolls from inside the pillars of Solomon's temple that were supposedly passed, were discovered by the Templars, and then passed down to Freemasons that followed them. But, you know, I hadn't actually heard the term flying scrolls before. But actually, Albert Pike writes about this idea in his Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. Well, the book is called Morals and Dogma, and and you can find all sorts of information there about the real meaning of Masonic rituals.
Well, I know when I went to Roslyn Chapel last summer, and I it was a fascinating building. I mean, it's small, but I spent, believe it or not, 5 hours in there with a camera, and literally I only thought I was in there for an hour or so. There are so many carvings into the walls and around the windows and pillars and supports and way up in the ceiling, little things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the figures that are carved into the walls, you know, some people call them Nephilim, they call them angels, they call them demons.
Mm-hmm.
They have all kinds of different shapes. Some of them have wings, some of them don't. Some of them are holding scrolls across their chest. Another, like I said before, is holding the heart of Robert the Bruce. And,
yeah.
So I don't know if you have run into the idea that maybe this perfect set of symbols of relationships that the Freemasons sort of cryptically allude to, like the compass and the square and all kinds of ratios and cryptographs, that they didn't make them up. They inherited them from somewhere way, way back.
Yeah, well, you alluded to the Nephilim, and that's this idea that angels, or some people think they're aliens, whatever, so, non-human or greater than human creatures came down from heaven and interbred with human females and created this hybrid race. And in addition to doing that, that they also gave to mankind a set of mysteries, and like spiritual mysteries, and also sort of scientific knowledge that was unheard of at the time. This would have been pre-Diluvian times. And so, there's a tradition, and it actually shows up in all sorts of ancient mythology and religious traditions and secret society traditions, that these mysteries were passed down from the gods or the angels to a certain select few of mankind, and then those people have in turn been passing the secrets down through the generations via secret societies such as Freemasonry. And, you know, I think that actually makes a lot of sense. I think that the pervasiveness of the myth, and the fact that it shows up almost identically in so many different cultures and time periods, indicates that it's a really strong sort of genetic memory that we all have of this transfer of information from heaven, and that the information was so sacred that it couldn't be shared with everyone, and it had to be passed down through a secret society of people who had taken an oath not to reveal the information to outsiders.
Mm. Oh, you raise a lot of interesting ideas. I try to use the rather innocuous term off-worlders and not talk about aliens or, you know, I'm sure we could talk about that, but for the purposes of trying to be as independent as I can and maybe not sound so conspiracy theorist, you know, way, it is clear that from primitive state, and I don't mean, you know, hunters and gatherers, I mean primitive in the sense that there was no real international working government. They were a world of tribes that somehow, out of whole cloth, they crafted what was destined to be a world government that would help people exchange labor from one side of the planet to the other. And although it's sacred, to be sure, those kinds of things, as you mentioned the name Cain, have a way of leaking out to the other side and getting copied, and the power thereof can't be denied, but the authority, I guess you can't own if you're evil, but you can still work the machine. So I guess we have two sides using truth in, you know, for their own means. One for the benefit of a world, which I guess they call Jerusalem or New Jerusalem or Atlantis or New Atlantis, and the other for world domination, you know, in either religiously or militarily. At least that's what I see. You know, you see people, you see Hitler, you see Caesar, you see all these individuals trying to use the same principles to wrest control from the legitimate leadership.
Well, I would say that definitely the people who have referred to these mysteries and the practices of these traditions as evil generally are outsiders putting their own judgment upon the practices of a society they're not involved in. Or in the case of the Catholic Church in the past, they've always had a rivalry with Freemasonry and told their members not to participate in it because they say, you know, it's evil to take an oath to something other than God, and then you're participating in occult rituals that go back to pre-Christian mysteries. And, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I mean, if you come from that perspective where you think anything non-Christian is evil, then I suppose Freemasonry is evil, but from the perspective of the Freemason or the person participating in the ritual, you know, it's there's nothing evil about it.
Yeah, exactly right. And even the Muslims, they do the same thing. The idolatry that is, you know, so all permeates Freemasonry. It's you don't practice it under penalty of death. So they really try to avoid idolatry at all costs.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah, everyone has their own definition of idolatry. Of course, the Catholics don't think they're participating in idolatry when they do ceremonies in front of little statues of Mary or Jesus. So, again, it's all in the eye of the beholder. And, of course, every religion or every group will say what we're doing is the right way and everything that anyone else does is the wrong way.
Well, I personally think it's political cartoons that are the real abomination. Well, I know you can't discuss a lot of the secrets behind the symbols they use, but the symbols are pretty common. We understand it. But why is symbolism so important to Freemasonry?
Well, it really is a tradition going back to pre-Diluvian times. It's going back to a time when a lot of people couldn't even read and do math. And I think symbols were a way of communicating ideas without having to write down paragraph and paragraph of explanation, that it was a way of communicating information quickly and easily in a way that could be remembered and passed down. And also, symbols are, they touch our soul. They're archetypal. And even if you haven't been told what a symbol means, you usually have an instinctive understanding of it. And I think that that's why, not only in Freemasonry, but in all mystery traditions, symbols have been used as the means of teaching the mysteries to new initiates.
Mm. Well, I know they use the compass and they use the square. And you mentioned the Rosicrucians. That comes from the word rose?
Rose cross, yeah.
Yeah. Why do they use the rose in the cross?
It's been said to be a symbol of union of masculinity and femininity, that the cross represents male sort of left-brained ideas, and then the cross represents femininity and right-brained ideas. Or the cross is masculine and the rose is feminine. And that's one way of looking at it. And then more than that, it's like the rose blossoming out of the cross kind of represents alchemical transformation. That's what's been said. And it's a symbol that not only the Rosicrucians used, but the Templars also had a red cross that they used, and it means the same thing, I believe.
Yeah, I noticed in the crest that's embedded in the walls of the castle at Lochnow, which is the one that Agnew's built,
mm-hmm.
They have roses. There's three or four roses, and then there's the cross, and then the compass are all on the same shield. And if you go to Roslyn Chapel, they in the ceiling arch, they've got whole fields of roses carved in that ceiling. It's about 15 meters high. It's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think all these symbols, including the compass and square, again, it's almost symbolizes the same thing. The square makes a square with when you're using it in masonry, and the compass creates a circle. The square is a masculine symbol, the circle is a feminine symbol, and the union of the two represents this sort of transcendental idea of the unity of opposites, which is really sort of the secret at the heart of all of these mystery traditions, including Freemasonry. They're trying to teach you how to understand the universe and nature and reality in a transcendental way without categorizing everything into masculine and feminine or evil and or good and things like that. They're trying to give you a godlike perspective, really, on things, which is a transcendental perspective. And so that's why all of these symbols are ways of categorizing and harmonizing the elements of the universe.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. I like the word union. I know in some of the more metaphysical readings that I've gone through, they talk about a union of the spiritual and the physical,
mm-hmm.
and that the earth itself has a physical and spiritual component.
Right.
And it is this union that that makes the earth so perfect.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, that's the union of physical and spiritual is an important thing to bear in mind, too, when you're thinking about this race of beings, the Nephilim, and, you know, whether to call them aliens or gods or angels or whatever, it's important to realize that I think ancient man saw them as being both physical flesh and blood beings, and also at the same time they were spiritual beings. And I don't know if that means that they could zap in and out of physical reality or what, but they were definitely thought of as both. And even after the Nephilim left the earth and left mankind to fend for itself, men still tried to contact their gods or the people that they had gotten this information from through spiritual means. And so they believed that even though the Nephilim weren't physically on earth anymore, that they could still be contacted. And yeah, I think that's the real way of understanding the nature of the Nephilim, is to understand that they're both physical and spiritual beings. But unfortunately, a lot of people who write about them can't really get over that idea, and they have to categorize them into one or the other, and it ends up with a lot of misunderstanding, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the shortcomings of the human brain, I think. It can't think in multiple dimensions, or at least beyond the third one.
Uh-huh.
Well, I noticed, at least in some writings and some things that I've researched, that ancient Freemasonry, maybe they weren't called Freemasons at that time, that they were involved in the construction of the Temple of Solomon. I know if you look at the architecture of the Temple of Solomon and you look at the architecture of Roslyn Chapel, except for scale, they're very similar.
Well, yeah, definitely the building of the Temple of Solomon was a really important thing in the Old Testament, and the exact proportions of the Temple of Solomon were laid out very precisely in the text of the Old Testament, and you know, God dictated those things directly to the who did he dictate it to? Anyway, the dimensions were dictated by God. I can't remember who the recipient was at the time, but and then there's even stories, extra biblical stories, about how King Solomon contacted demons and had them help him create the Temple of Solomon. And so whatever tradition you look at, they're definitely attributing the Temple of Solomon to they're saying that it was a very important symbol of the Jewish people, but also of God and the universe. And the Freemasons, definitely their traditions go back to the Temple of Solomon, and the idea of within Freemasonry of using sacred geometry to communicate divine ideas. They're supposedly, according to their own traditions, they're using the same wisdom of sacred geometry that was used in the Temple of Solomon. And according to their traditions, that was passed down from the Templars to modern-day Freemasons.
Yeah,
so it's not surprising that Roslyn Chapel and other buildings that have been built by Templars or Freemasons would reflect the same proportions and dimensions as Solomon's Temple.
Yeah, well, it's definitely clear that there was not a lot of trial and error in building these buildings. There weren't a lot of blocks thrown away.
Oh, no, yeah. I went to Roslyn Chapel last summer, too, probably similar, around the same time as you. And
July.
It was like every single square inch is covered in something, and it's all been very precisely laid out. And there was one relief on the ceiling that the guide told us was a mistake, and it ended up making the opposite statement that you would think that a normal symbol in a church would make, and the guide was saying, oh, they made a mistake on this one. And I don't believe that at all. I mean, there's not a mistake anywhere in that building. So, and I'm sure if the Temple of Solomon were here today, that you could say the same thing about it.
Yeah, exactly. We'll cover a lot more of that, because I don't know how long it took them to build it or what kind of blueprints they had, but that building is quite incredible.
Uh-huh.
And how it's laid out. I crawled all over the scaffolding and went down in the basement. I've been all over that thing. I wanted them to take up the carpet because I wanted to see if there was a Star of David in the floor, but they wouldn't do it.
Oh, shucks.
Darn. And well, I want to get back to the Temple of Solomon, because
sure.
I mean, it's clear that the prophet received that information. What we have of it is recorded in, you know, a very truncated Old Testament document, because obviously every single detail is not in the Old Testament. But somehow the prophet got involved with those that had the skill to build the temple. And it was clear that the dimensions and the relationships between different materials had to be precise, not because they needed someplace really beautiful. The way God explained it in the Bible, this building is going to have a special purpose and a special ability. And it's going to be the place where I interface with you.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was some kind of dimensional property that had to be adhered to in the construction of this building, and it took special artisans to do it. So I don't know where the artisans got their skill, because they had built nothing like this prior to this.
Well, actually, the artisans came from Tyre, a Phoenician island, and the King Solomon, and even his forefather, King David, had all had a relationship with King Hiram of Tyre for a long time. They had a good relationship, a trading partnership, and David had actually tried to start the temple, and he wasn't successful in finishing it.
Well, God had too much blood on his hands. So
King Hiram had agreed to help them build the temple. So not only did he provide all of the cedar trees that were used in it and a lot of other materials, but he also provided all the laborers. And the interesting thing is that there's a temple on Tyre that has a lot of the same dimensions and architectural properties that the Temple of Solomon is said to have had. And so it seems that the artisans who came from Tyre to work in Jerusalem were using basically the same blueprint. It was a temple to Melkart in Tyre that they were kind of mimicking when they created the Temple of Solomon.
So it does predate the Temple of Solomon.
Yeah. But I think that these artisans from King Hiram were probably allied together. They were probably in a guild together, very similar to early forms of Freemasonry. Early forms of Freemasonry came out of Masonic guilds that were building cathedrals in Europe. And I think they had a guild in Tyre that was very similar, that not only were they all artisans with that knew how to do masonry and create buildings, but they also knew how to embed sacred geometric properties into those buildings.
Well,
so that there is another point of origin for some of the mysteries of Freemasonry is right there, King Hiram's own artisans.
It would be interesting to study the charter of that guild to see where they got their ideas from. Well, did you discover anything peculiar about the methods by which they cut the stones that they so perfectly laid? When I looked at the stones, at Roslyn Chapel, but also in South America, when I look at that large granite stones set there, I don't see any hammer marks. How do people with their bare hands quarry stone like that and move it around?
Yeah, that is one of the mysteries of the ancient world. A lot of the monolithic creations from the ancients have the same properties. Yeah, that the stones are so close together that you don't even understand how they could have possibly done it. And there is a tradition about how the Temple of Solomon was created. Masonic tradition says that Hiram's artisans used this thing called the Shamir worm, which supposedly is like a little magical snake that can cut stone without you having to use any metal utensils. And actually, in the Bible and in Masonic tradition, it says that Hiram's artisans weren't allowed to use any metallic objects in creating the Temple of Solomon. So, I mean, imagine trying to do that. Yeah, no one really knows how they did it. And so magical means are the lore says that, you know, magic was used. And then again, that sort of explains why extra-biblical traditions would say that demons created the Temple of Solomon, because it was such a magnificent creation and so intricate that human beings couldn't have possibly have done it. And so, yeah, I think it's a mystery. I don't really know. I think that's one of the things that the ancient Masons, not the modern Masons, but the ancient ones, that was one of their secrets And I don't think anyone in modern times has really discovered it.
I know one document that I read two or three years ago, I think we used it on our bibliography for our book, said that obviously no hammers were heard in the quarry, but there was this buzzing sound. They said it sounded like bees.
Huh.
And when I go around, you know, the world doing photo shoots or trying to do research about this, I see these statues of beings. Some of them have wings and some of them don't. Some are giant, some are regular size. But in their right hand, they're always holding this little bag or this little toolbox or something.
And mm-hmm.
Like they hold it out in front of them. And my co-author, E.J. Clark, and I have kind of surmised that, you know, maybe that is the symbol of their rock melter. Maybe it's this little thing that you're talking about, this little serpent that's able to cut through stone. Because when you look at these granite stones, and some of them are, my goodness, they're 6, 7, 8, 10 tons, and they're fit together, you know, so tightly you can't put a piece of paper or a knife blade between them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know a lot of masons that lay stone, and they chip and hammer at it with their hammers all day long, and they still have to use mortar to make stuff fit together. But none of these buildings used any mortar to fit together.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you, except that it does seem like ancient man had access to technologies that we don't have today. And I don't know if it really is technology, if it's a machine that they built that allows them to do it, or if, you know, if we're talking about a time period in which they were still being influenced by these Nephilim or these extra human beings, maybe those beings had something to do with the creation of these buildings, because... Yeah, how else did they do it? And the way that these beings are described, not only are they giants with wings, but they have magical abilities as well. And so who knows how they did it, but ancient tradition says that they had magical extra human help at some point.
Well, I could see why, if those beings did bring that kind of technology to the earth, it was quite easy to gather the support of the surrounding people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in those days, I guess anyone with that kind of ability, I mean, if I showed up with a Chevrolet truck in those days and said, hey, I can haul that for you, I would have been seen as a god, too.
Did you ever see The Man Who Would Be King?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the whole premise of that movie is that Alexander the Great was a Freemason, and he had impressed himself upon these people, and I think Kazakhstan or something, somewhere way out there, and had, you know, become their god and their leader. And when these modern day Freemasons, played by Michael Caine and I forget the other guy, anyway, they came to the same tribal area, and as soon as the tribesmen saw that they had the Masonic symbol around their necks, they fell down and started worshiping them because they believed that they were the descendants of Alexander, their god. And so,
and they
yeah.
The scam as long as they could. I remember the movie. It had a lot of humor and drama in it. It was quite good. But it just, you know, was probably the way that off-worlders or I don't want to call them extraterrestrials, but they were clearly much, much more advanced than any society, even the prophets of that time. And for the prophets to be instructed, I assume they were instructed, go get the masons at Tyre and tell them to build this temple, because they have these skills that have been taught to them over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating. And when I look at the symbolism, and it's almost a cryptic language, even though they spoke English, even though they could communicate perfectly well, some of the symbols were deceptive. That is to say, they appeared to be, you know, cultish, but when you cryptically decode it, it's actually quite divine. And I'll give you an example in a second. I know a lot of people today say that Masonry or Freemasonry is some kind of cult.
Uh-huh.
And I hear the word cult a lot, but what would your definition of a cult be?
Well, of a cult, Okay, not a cult.
What makes a cult?
Okay. Yeah, I would say in the modern parlance, a cult is a group that uses deceptive mind control practices to try to keep their members enslaved to the group. And, you know, I don't think Freemasonry is that at all. But in a more historical sense, the term cult just means any religious group, any group that gets together and does religious rituals. So the word culture comes from cult. It's, our culture is derives from the sort of religious taboos and beliefs and practices of the region that we came from. So that's the word cult. But I don't think in the modern parlance of a cult being a something that uses deceptive mind control practices to try to enslave its members. I don't think that's what Freemasonry is at all. It's quite different.
Right. So, I mean, what you're saying is all cults are not evil. And, you say a cult is one that uses mind control to control its members.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really say that modern churches are not like that. I mean, they use music and they use fear of going to hell, fear
mm-hmm.
of burning, forever in a lake of fire and brimstone. In medieval times, it was the fear of being shunned or shut out from society.
Mm-hmm.
The church of various ones, Christian churches and non-Christian churches, use that kind of control to keep their congregations in line and paying tithing.
Mm-hmm.
And governments do it too. We use propaganda, and nowadays we're even using, mind control weaponry like HAARP and different things like that. So,
right.
Cults are everywhere, and I guess in that sense, when it robs you of your free agency, your will to choose, and indoctrinates you somehow, then it's evil.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say that the Freemasons were evil?
No. I mean, no. In fact, I have a really positive view of Freemasonry. I mean, it's had a really positive impact on history, that they were basically responsible for creating Enlightenment philosophy in the 1700s, the idea that that the universe could be understood rationally, and so people should use the scientific method to try to understand the universe rather than just believing whatever the dominating church told them to believe about the universe. And then that led to these ideas of natural rights, human rights, and freedom of religion and freedom of speech and democracy. And if it hadn't been for Freemasonry, none of these things would have taken over society, and we would still be under the influence of a church of some sort. But they came up with the idea, instead, let's create a society where the government is secular and people are allowed to worship as they please and the government doesn't tell them what to think. And let's have a society where you're not under pressure to use the church's teachings as your basis for understanding the universe. Let's instead use our rationality to understand the universe, and then use the teachings of the church in conjunction with that. But so I would say Freemasons were really responsible for freeing our society from the negative influence of the church at the time, and that's been a really positive influence on society. If it hadn't been for them, things would be totally different.
So somehow, it appears that the Freemasons not only had the knowledge of how to fit stone together and make holy edifices, they also had knowledge of how to design a government that would fit a free society.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that idea is really so ancient, but it's something that sort of came about. Like, the Templars were oppressed by the church that they served, the Catholic Church, and one of the things they had always wanted to do, the Templars, was to create their own autonomous state that they could rule according to their own unique philosophic principles. And when they were disbanded, obviously they weren't able to do that, but it appears that they passed along this plan to the Freemasons that started the First Lodge in Scotland, and then the plan continued on from there. And they expanded upon the plan. They said, if we're going to create this autonomous society, here's how it's going to work. This is the only way that it could work. And it's like this sort of idea would have flowed naturally from a Masonic lodge, because at the time, in the early days of Freemasonry, that would have been one of the only places where people could gather of different religions together without having to worry about their neighbors or even the authorities creating problems for them. And then it's also one of the only places where different people of different social strata could gather, and according to the rules of Freemasonry, when you're in the lodge, you're all on equal terms, no matter what your social status is. And so being within the Freemasonic lodge naturally fostered these ideas. Let's create a society that operates on the same principles.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Not only people of different religions, but as we will see in our next hour, people of different governments are able to come together and supersede their allegiances, shall we say. My guest tonight is Tracy Twyman, and we're talking about Freemasonry, ancient societies, and in our next hour we're going to talk about how Freemasonry was used to create the idea of America, and we'll go into a lot of detail on that. We will probably reach back into this original roots section of Freemasonry. We've got a few more really, really good questions in that section, but I would like to, well, not like to, I have to knock out a few commercials, so if you want to take about a four-minute break, we'll come back at exactly right at the top of the hour, and I'll take care of paying some bills. We'll do about a 48-second musical interlude, and we'll be back with our guest, Tracy Twyman. Hey, one of the things we've learned from our many emails that we get is that there are many listeners to this program who are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you, the Academic Superstore. It's a place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. I think if you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. And this time of year, people are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give to people they love. Well, now there's a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it will allow you to keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world, and because of their love for Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Earlier we talked about telescopes, and if you have ever thought about owning one, I mean a really good telescope, the best place to go is the Discovery Store. You can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way in Elmo. They're very simple to use. They're all programmable. You just point and shoot. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. And there's no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You just might save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. That's x2-radio.com. And we will be back after a short 48-second interlude with my guest, Tracy Twyman. This is X Squared Radio, and I'm Brooks Agnew. We'll be right back. And normally he comes on and tells me, okay, I'm playing music now.
I'll just assume that it's playing.
Yes.
I apologize for that. We're still...
I knew you were there.
Yeah, we're here. I'm about to play your second hour, and it's playing now. I'm trying to automate this now, so that what it's going to do is it basically is going to allow me to automate everything, but the automation system's a little weird, and so sometimes it gets the wrong track. Like normally I want it to be automate immediately after a live show. It immediately starts running the music. So it's a little tricky. I can't quite figure it out yet.
We have to synchronize our watches.
Pardon me?
We have to synchronize our watches. I have exactly 10 seconds after the hour.
Yeah, that's actually, I have 10 seconds to the hour right now.
Okay. We'll try to 2 minutes to the second then.
And we're still running the second hour promo.
This comes out in stereo in the archive. It sounds very good, Tracy.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully I can get a copy.
Okay, we're going live in 5, 4, 3... 2, 1.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest is Tracy Twyman. In our first hour, we covered the ancient roots of Freemasonry, and I'm sure we'll touch on that again. In this hour, we're going to see if we can follow Freemasonry as it relates to the founding of America. One thing that I'm sure our listeners want to know, there is an ancient prophecy of a great nation of freedom and liberty being established in the last days. Some of them called it New Jerusalem, some called it New Atlantis. It was supposed to be a land of untold wealth, personal prosperity, and most importantly, liberty. Now, my ancestors were involved with the early Knights of Christ, and the Magna Carta even mentions one of my direct line by name. But some of the names, I guess, who supported the Magna Carta, let's see, Master Pandulf, subdeacon and member of the household of our Lord, the Pope, and Brother Aymeric, Master of the Knights of the Temple in England, and of the illustrious men William Marshall, Earl of Pembroke, William Earl of Salisbury, and William Earl of Warren, William Earl of Arundel, and Alan Agnew of Galloway. Those are just a few of the names on the Magna Carta. That was 1215, and it said that the Knights of Christ were in possession of some very special documents that may have contained some maps of the world. Some of them may have been crafted by Noah's family after they were ordered to go around the world and map it after the flood. These were transcribed, I guess, from century to century to preserve them, but they were kept sacred because they contained the location of the New Jerusalem. In your book, Solomon's Treasure, by the way, I want you to tell us, tell our listeners how we can get a copy of Solomon's Treasure.
Okay. You can get it at our website, dragonkeypress.com, all one word. And if you prefer, you can also go to amazon.com. And my name, just so you all know, is Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, middle initial R, and last name is T-W-Y-M-A-N. And then the book is called Solomon's Treasure, The Magic and Mystery of America's Money. We also have some other books that I've written, and you can look those up on dragonkeypress.com.
Yes, we'll have those books and the links posted on our website as well. Solomon's Treasure is absolutely fascinating. I read it once. Now I'm going back through it with a pen, and I'm writing in the margins. You've done some incredible research.
Thanks.
And you say that Columbus's father-in-law was a Knight of Christ. Very interesting.
Yeah, that, I got that information from Manly P. Hall, who was a 33rd degree Freemason himself and wrote lots of books, one of which was The Secret Destiny of America, where he says that he believes that the colonization of the New World and then the creation of the United States in that location was all part of a Masonic plan that also went back to the Knights of Christ and the Knights Templar. Knights of Christ are basically like an offshoot of the Knights Templar that came about after the Templars were disbanded. And they were particularly involved in nautical studies. A lot of them were sailors or explorers. And one of them was Prince Henry Sinclair, or Prince Henry the Navigator, who was one of the Lords of Rosslyn, one of the patrons, excuse me, of the First Lodge of Freemasonry. And it's believed, according to the lore, and according to this book by Manly P. Hall, that that Columbus was involved in this ancient plan as well to colonize the United States, that he had been given maps about ancient maps from inside sources that showed him how to go there, and that the plan really had nothing to do with finding India, that he intended to land there all along. And an interesting thing is that Columbus is said to be illiterate, or at least that's what I was taught in school.
Well, he was smart enough to marry into a very strong family.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, his it was his, I think he was father-in-law who was supposedly responsible for giving him the map.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was the family he married into that was involved with the Knights of Christ. And then, yeah, this Prince Henry the Navigator is also a Knight of Christ, and he, too, is said to have come into possession of one of these maps from an inside source. And so it's believed that he made a voyage even before Columbus and checked out the land and, you know, made better maps and better plans about what to do with it for the future. And so that's, they believe, why there's representations of maize and aloe plants, and there's one other thing. Anyway, all these three things were, tobacco. And these plants are all native to America, to this continent, and they had never seen them in Britain, in Scotland, and yet these things are represented on the walls of Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland, which leads some people to believe that they're there because Prince Henry visited the New World and came back and had his artisans create representations of these plants on the walls of his chapel.
Hmm. So Columbus gets the map from his father-in-law, knows what it's for, and so why did he go to the Habsburgs to get financing to go?
Well, to get financing.
Yeah, but if the Freemasons were so wealthy and they had the means and they had the knowledge, why did Columbus go to Spain to get financing?
Well, I don't know how wealthy the Knights of Christ were that he was involved with, but you know, the Habsburgs had money and wanted to colonize the New World, and so it's a reasonable place to go. Also, the Habsburgs, the connection is really tangential, but it's a family that's connected to other families that are connected to the Knights Templar traditionally. So you know, there's possible connections there.
Well, was there anybody special that went on this first voyage with Columbus?
Well, supposedly, according to Manly Hall, there was another member of this secret society, he calls it. I think it's probably Knights of Christ that he's referring to. He says that there was this guide, basically, on board that was telling Columbus what to do every step of the way. But Manly P. Hall doesn't name him, so I don't really know what his name is, or even if he actually existed, or if this is just a myth.
Did he come back with Columbus on the boat?
No. That's right, no.
So
he supposedly left. He deboarded in the New World and didn't come back.
Wow. So why do you think he went? Do you think he went to guide Columbus the whole way, or do you think he just went because it was time for him to go to the New World and not come back?
Well, it makes sense that he would have been there to guide Columbus. I mean, if, you know, only a handful of voyages to the New World had been made in secret in history, then there's reason to believe that, you know, Columbus might not make it if he didn't have a guide there to help him. So it's reasonable.
Interesting, though, that he didn't care about if Columbus made it back or not.
Well,
I'm just wondering, you know, it's kind of like I've seen several movies where explorers go to another planet and they say, okay, you know, the place is coming apart, you know, it's time for us to get back. And one of them always says, no, I'm staying behind. I think the most recent one was, what was the one with Clint Eastwood and where they went to the moon, or they went up to save a satellite, and Tommy Lee Jones ended up riding the satellite that had the Russian rockets on it, riding it to the moon.
Uh-huh.
He was the one that stayed behind in that voyage. There's always somebody that stays behind. But it seems so interesting that here is this amazingly experienced stranger, an unnamed stranger that's going to tag along behind, and I'll make sure you get there safely, but I'm staying when we get there.
Well, it's in line with the way secret societies operate, I think. There's a lot of stories of mysterious strangers that do things like there was a mysterious stranger that handed off the rituals for the Scottish Rite Freemasonry to Baron von Hund in a darkened room where he wasn't able to see who it was. And then there's a stranger that supposedly influenced the writing of the Declaration of Independence. And
he
was in the room and he told the people what to write, and then he disappeared before they finished. But these are all stories, you know. Who knows how true it is.
Well, I mean, you have to look at the evidence, you know. Did Columbus get lost? No.
Yeah.
Had he ever been there before? No. So, you know, somebody knew how to get there, and I'm sure you have maps, but when you're in the middle of the ocean, how long was the Santa Maria? I mean, it was like 48 feet long, and you're sailing along with 80 and 90 foot seas, and your crew wants to commit a mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have three little boats, but they sail straight there. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, and I don't believe this thing about them looking for a passage to India. Maybe that's what they told the Habsburgs, and maybe that's how they motivated them to finance it.
That's what I'm thinking. They appealed to the Habsburgs' greed and said, you know, we're going to find a shorter trade route to India.
Right.
That's pretty interesting. Well, I mean, when I was in grade school, I was taught that, you know, Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue in 1492, and I also learned that our country got its name from Amerigo Vespucci, a map maker. I can't believe a country would be named after a map maker, but is that really where the country got its name?
Not according to my research. There's a lot of different theories about it, and I find some of the different theories to be more believable than, yeah, that someone misread Amerigo Vespucci's name and thought that that was the name of the place. But actually, there's one source that says that America comes from Ameriku, which means land of the plumed serpent in Mayan. So it might have been an original Indian name that kind of got changed. And, again, meaning land of the plumed serpent, kind of, I don't know, some people think that that's evidence of why Freemasons are evil, that they named America after a serpent or the devil. Anyway, there's one theory. There's another theory. Well, it's a little complicated, so I won't even go into that. But basically, there's alternate reasons for where America got its name. And also, before it was called America, it was more generally referred to as Columbia, after Columbus. But Columbus wasn't really his name. I mean, no one really knows what his actual name was. That was just sort of his title or what he was called. And it really means little dove. So, in the book, I kind of theorize about why Columbus would have been called the dove and why our country then would have been called Columbia. And now there always has been. Columbia has been personified into the national goddess. She sort of represents our own national version of Venus or Astarte. And she's dressed very much like Pallas Athena in the Greek tradition. She has the helmet and everything. Anyway, so Columbia, the word Columbia is obviously very important to the meaning of America. And so what does it mean? It means dove. And it actually goes back to this story that allegorically tells the story of a boat going through this passage where there are these two rocks crashing together. And so the captain of the boat sent forward this dove to see if it could go through the passage without getting killed by the crashing rocks. And when it made it all the way through safely, then the boat knew that it could go through safely also. And so I saw that as sort of allegorical of Columbus's role in history, that he went forward ahead of the other Freemasons and members of secret societies that were planning on colonizing the United States or America. He went ahead and demonstrated that the voyage could be made, and you know, thus playing the role, the same role as the dove in that story. So
I'm also really interested in the motif of the plumed serpent, because in my trips to that area of the world, down in Mayan country, the plumed serpent is a Christ motif.
Yeah, yeah, and they all of these south of the border Indian tribes have these traditions of a guy named Quetzalcoatl, according to the Mexicans, and then he's called Kukulkan in other traditions, but it's the same figure of, they say there's this white person with a beard that came in long ago times, so long ago they can't even remember, and taught their people more advanced technologies. Well, not technology so much as just improvements on their current level of civilization, and helped them to build those magnificent temples. All the Indian tribes down there believe that they're magnificent temples that, you said, you can't figure out how they even built them. They say they were built by these creatures, these white people that came a long time ago from a place that they don't know where. And so we have all heard that, you know, when the Spaniards came and basically wiped out and subdued the Indians, they were welcomed because they thought that they were the return of this white race of gods that had come before.
And the very date of their arrival and mode of their arrival had been foretold by them using the Tolkien calendar, which is what was used to fashion the ancient Mayan calendar, which makes up a bunch of 2012 things as well. We could go into that, but let's stay on subject.
Yeah.
Let's jump forward about 300 years, okay? The colonists of America, they're becoming rebellious against the British crown. They want to be independent. And, you know, first of all, did the Freemasons have anything to do with birthing what we know as the American spirit? You know, Americans are completely unique when it comes to our heritage. It's not that we're rebels, it's that we've got this American spirit about us. And did Freemasonry have anything to do with the development of that? What made us so independent?
Yeah, I would say that they did. Again, I talked about last hour. I talked about how Freemasons were largely responsible for creating Enlightenment philosophy, and then the ideas of freedom and democracy that, you know, that really came from the Masonic Lodge. And then Freemasons were very much influential even before the creation of the United States. They were influential in the continental governments there in the colonies, and so they definitely were responsible for fomenting this sort of domestic identity amongst the Americans, the colonists, that was different from Britain, where they had come from. And it was the idea to rebel against Britain did come out of Masonic lodges. Like the Boston Tea Party was perpetrated by the Sons of Liberty. They were all members of the same Masonic Lodge in Boston. And then I've got some statistics for you. Up to 16% of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, 33% of the signers of the U.S. Constitution, and 46% of the generals of the Continental Army were all Masons. And then you have the fact that a lot of the commanders in the British Army were Masons, too. So some authors have suggested that Britain almost purposely lost the war, that basically they weren't capable of winning the war because there were so many double agents within their own military who were more loyal to Freemasonry than they were to Britain, and they were being told by their lodge members to help the Americans out, that this was part of the grand plan that America would become independent. And so
yeah.
We know that Benjamin Franklin was running lodge brothers of his Masonic lodges as continental agents in the British Army. And he also had some lodge brothers in France who were funneling money to the Continental Army. So it was very much a Masonic rebellion from the beginning.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things to throw in there. The Solomons in Jerusalem funneled literally millions of dollars, and which would have been billions of dollars today, to the Continental Army. In fact, they died paupers in funneling, and there was no way the New Jerusalem or America could have been founded without that money. And it's interesting, but let's go back just a little bit. So we decide to declare independence. That's not the end of the story, obviously, but so Thomas Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence in a very short time, and there's a committee that goes over it, but there was only one draft. I mean, he just sat down and wrote it. And that sort of adds, I don't know if it's mystique or credence, to the idea that there was a mysterious stranger, or at least a scroll or some document that Thomas Jefferson went by in order to craft that document. And it is incredible in its clarity. But the thing that's unique about it is never in history has there been a government formed or based on the tenets of inalienable or God-given rights.
Yeah, that's a purely Masonic idea, really.
Exactly.
And, that really is what defines the American spirit or ideal, because we don't have an ancestry. We don't have a royal tradition. We don't have any sort of past, any sort of culture to hang on to, except these Masonic ideals that our forefathers embraced. And I know that not all of the founding fathers were members of Freemasonry, but they were all influenced by the ideals. They were friends with people who were Freemasons. And when they had their meetings, they were all discussing these Enlightenment ideas. And so even if they weren't all members of the Brotherhood, they were all helping to forward the Masonic plan for creating a philosophic empire, or a New Jerusalem, as you called it, in the United States.
Yep, and it had, well, it had even bigger plans than that, because although New Jerusalem was going to be formed here, the tenets under which it was going to be supported would be eternal, would give society the rule over government and not the other way around, and it would lay the foundation for some kind of world commerce control. And we'll get into that a little more in the third hour, but it's interesting that, well, Adams, who's considered the father of the Constitution, said that, you know, Jefferson had copied the Declaration from some earlier writings, and Jefferson responded, I have the quote, I had to write it down because I couldn't memorize it. He said, "Neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind."
Wow.
That's a pretty powerful statement to be written in 1776, because I don't even know, really, even today, if we know what the American mind is.
Well, yeah, back then it was like at least 50% of the colonists still maintained their loyalty to Britain.
Yeah, they were loyal to the crown. But, you know, you can go to any baseball game or NASCAR race you want, go anywhere in the bleachers you want, and you can sample the American mind perfectly.
Yeah.
But you can't write it down. I don't know what it is. It's not just an independence or a fierce individualism, but even though we're a nation of individuals, when it comes to stress or challenge, we pull together as one.
You know, I've noticed something, paying attention to European politics, that they have a different idea of freedom than we do, because they have a long tradition of monarchy and royalty in their continent, that it's like their concept of freedom is different than ours, because our nation started with this Masonic concept of freedom. So in their, it seems to me, in European culture, the idea of rights is what you have a right to have, what you're entitled to, like possessions and a job and benefits and entitlements. And here, it's what you have the right to do. We have our concept of freedom is the freedom to do what we want. Our concept of equality is equal opportunity and treatment under the law. Whereas their idea of equality is the government making everyone have an equal amount of stuff. And so I think that, you know, I think the West as a whole has a tradition of freedom influenced by Freemasonry that continues to this day. But in Europe, it's not the same concept as it is in America, where we have, like you said, a very unique American spirit.
Well, that is a very interesting perspective, and I think it's perfectly accurate. This
Thanks.
Country is one where you have the freedom to do or be what you want to be in. And over there, and we see the evidence of it on the headlines. We see people rioting because they can be fired from a job.
Right.
Well, gee, people are fired every minute of every day in this country because they don't add enough value to justify their wages.
Uh-huh.
So, well, that's very interesting. Well, anyway, so we don't have any proof that Jefferson was a Freemason, at least none direct that I could find, but he certainly acted like one.
Right.
But we do know that George Washington was a Freemason.
And, yes.
And as the colonists declared independence and headed into war, we talked about Freemasonry being prolific on both sides of the army.
Yeah, so, and making it difficult for them to actually fight one another because they were loyal to the same overall cause.
Exactly, and that was of founding the New Jerusalem. And I think both sides, or at least the middle management or the middle officers, were convinced that America was that New Jerusalem, that it had to be independent of the crown. And I did a little bit of research into that. Of course, you know, a lot of the revolutionary battles were fought down in South Carolina. And I went down there and I researched a couple of the battle sites. And
mm-hmm.
the guide was telling us that this skirmish had happened. These two groups had come together. And I guess in those days they stood on either end of a field,
yep.
you know, standing up and took aim at each other and blasted away until the last man was standing. But in this particular skirmish, for some strange reason, the British soldiers were ordered to fire over the heads into the trees above the colonial army.
Wow.
And the colonial army cut them down to the man.
Ooh.
They sacrificed their lives so that the colonial army could move forward. They would not disobey the orders of the crown. They stood there and they fought, but they were ordered to miss.
Wow.
And that was pretty powerful to me. We were quite amazed to find that story. And another story was when George Washington was in Valley Forge. You know, his men were emaciated. He was about out of supplies.
Right.
And the weather was just grueling on all of them. And so when they captured British patrols, they would obviously take their stuff.
Uh-huh.
But George Washington had an order that all the officers' things were to be brought to him, and then he would, you know, dole them out to his leadership. And one of the items that was brought to him was a bag, and on the bag was a Freemason symbol.
Ah.
So George Washington ordered the man that belonged to that bag to be delivered to him, which he was, and they spoke for about half the evening, they said, maybe 4 or 5 hours. That prisoner of war was treated well through the war and afterwards returned to England. And when he got on up in years, George Washington was still president. He asked George Washington to come to his bed when he was dying and dress him. I guess there's a certain way that Freemasons are dressed before burial.
Uh-huh.
And George Washington did that. He went to Europe and he dressed this man for burial and then returned. So there's a tremendous brotherhood on either side of the war in Freemasonry. And
mm-hmm.
at least it's my belief, maybe not my total contention, but my belief that it superseded the difference of an army coming to this continent and quelling some rebellion. And honestly, I don't see any other way they could have won, because the colonialists, they were outgunned, they were outmanned, they were outsupplied, they were outtrained.
Mm-hmm.
All these British troops were battle-hardened. You know, we were farmers and, you know, candlestick makers. And we won. And the only way it could have been done is because they succumbed to the covenant of forming the New Jerusalem over serving the crown in Britain.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think, you know, some, not all, but some of the most important members of the British Army really kind of forfeited the fight because of that, because of their loyalty to Freemasonry.
Mm.
And then, but you bring up George Washington, and George Washington was so open about being a Freemason, and he's really responsible for bringing a lot of the overt Masonic character to the birth of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
So that when he took his oath of office, he was dressed in Masonic regalia with his hand resting on a Masonic Bible, and he was the one who decided where Washington, D.C. would be laid out. And he was directly involved in the ceremonies, the Cornerstone Lane ceremonies, for when the Capitol building was laid, when the White House was laid, and also the city of Washington, D.C. itself actually had a Cornerstone Lane ceremony when it was mapped out. And all those Cornerstone Lane ceremonies were all Masonic ceremonies. They were done in public. People were in their Masonic regalia. It's like the ceremonies that initiated the United States were openly Masonic ceremonies. And then the city of Washington, D.C. itself is really interesting because the design of it was all laid out according to Masonic principles. And they were open about this at the time when they started it. The city was started as a perfect square, or actually it was more of a diamond if you looked at it from a north-south perspective. And it was a perfect 100-mile square grid. And so they were able to lay out all sorts of geometry on it, with the main streets and landmarks forming pentagrams and golden mean proportions and all of these things that are very important to sacred geometry in the Freemasonic tradition. And some of it's been ruined now because some of the land across the Potomac was given back to Maryland and Virginia. So the city is no longer a perfect square, but it's still laid out according to Masonic principles, and there's Masonic geometry all over the layout of the city itself. And also, if you look at the architecture of the major buildings, there's Masonic stuff all over the place. And, you know, no one's really shy about this in Washington, D.C. And there's even a person who has the job of architect of the Capitol, is what it's called. And their job is to oversee new landmarks, new creations in Washington, D.C. that change the landscape in any way. And his job is to make sure that all of the changes are in league with the original plan of the Masonic founders. So even today, the government is still somewhat open about the fact that there's a Masonic plan in place in Washington, D.C.
Fascinating.
I know.
Now, many conspiracy theorists would say, oh, you know, Freemasonry is the secret society, the New World Order. And I've heard that word even before people were talking about conspiracies of one world orders. But are one world orders necessarily evil?
Well, no. I mean, obviously, even like the Bible and its plan for the future, you know, when Jesus comes back, it's going to be a one world ruled by him as the king. So all of our cultural traditions have this inherent idea that someday in the future we're going to have a utopia on Earth, a one-world government where everything is perfect. And, you know, I don't know if that's ever actually going to happen, but it's an ideal that people have always had. And I don't see why a one-world government is any more or less corrupt than a national government. I mean, it all depends on who's running it.
A national government can be opposed by another nation somehow, but a one-world government having total control, if... And I have no problem with Jesus running it, but anybody less than him, I would think, would be on skating on thin ice as far as becoming corrupt, because absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, I see how a city councilman gets elected, and he thinks he owns the town, and the next thing you know, he's a millionaire because he bought a piece of property for a song from the city and sold it to Hardee's for $2 million. You know, there's all kinds of corruption at all levels, and when I hear people say, well, the government this and the government that,
yeah.
I've had some dealings with government and been a campaign speechwriter on a few levels, and I've seen that there's no such thing as the government. There are groups inside the government that serve themselves, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate and the Congress, they can't agree on the time of day, let alone anything else. And if they could feed themselves from the public coffers, they would certainly do that. And now, at least in the last couple of decades, the public has figured out how to feed itself from the public coffers, and so we have that drain as well. You mentioned that in Europe, people believe that freedom is the right of access to public support, free healthcare, free education, free job, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And that kind of demand for entitlement is seeping into our country as well. We have people that think that basic things, not inalienable rights, but basic things should be rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be provided by the government at the pleasure of the rich. They should pay for it. And our national debt goes up by the second because of it. But, you know, when we talk about this global economy, we talk about economy at all. In ancient days, you know, the candlestick maker went to town and traded his candlesticks for wheat, and then the shepherd traded his sheep for, finished goods. Cotton growers traded their stuff for furniture, and that was the way it was done. But the Masons, the Freemasons, had a way of generating the idea of a bank, of a check, of a way of converting labor done in Turkey into finished goods in Bulgaria. And they had a way of transferring that wealth. Can you describe for us basically how did they get that started? And maybe there were some starts and stops to that.
Well, yeah, the idea of modern banking, of checking, that you could write a check that represents money and present it to someone else and it would be accepted, that all comes from the Knights Templar. They started the first modern banks. Basically, it started out where the Knights Templar were created to be the official guardians of pilgrims en route to the Holy Land. And a lot of people wonder how they would have possibly done that, especially since there were only 9 knights at the beginning. And actually, this is how they helped to protect pilgrims. Pilgrimages used to be very dangerous before the Templars came around, because you would have to take all of your gold and supplies and travel with them all the way to Jerusalem, and you're going to get robbed somewhere along the way. And that was one of the main problems with people who wanted to make pilgrimages. And so the Templars invented this system. They had preceptories all over Europe, usually connected to a cathedral or a church, and they decided to create a system, a route to the Holy Land, where people would go through their different preceptories along the way, and they could deposit their money at the starting place, at that original preceptory that's nearest to where they lived. And then the Templars would give them a chit, as it was called, as a piece of paper. It's basically the same thing as a check now, and that's where the word comes from, which was ciphered with information that told the next recipient of the check how much money was in the person's account. And so then, when they would go on to the next stopping point on their pilgrimage, they would stop at another Templar preceptory and hand over their chit. And then that person at the Templar preceptory would give them a little bit of money, whatever they chose to withdraw from their account, so that they didn't have to carry it with them the whole way. And no one else would be able to use the chit, because it was ciphered. It was written with coded information that only Templars knew how to decipher. And so that was the first banking system. And, that grew to a more complicated banking system, where they were able to loan money out to noblemen and other aristocrats that were running the governments of Europe at the time. And so that's eventually what led to their demise, actually, is they had loaned so much money out to the important people in Europe, and especially France, that, like the King of France, his name was Philip le Bel, he couldn't pay back the Templars. He owed them so much money. So that's when he created this conspiracy with the Pope, Clement V, to arrest the Templars on charges of heresy, because he, for one thing, he owed them money and he couldn't pay them back. Another thing is, he had heard that they were so wealthy, he thought if he busted them and took all of their jewels and their gold, that he would be wealthy too. But when they busted the Templars and they went through their preceptories, they didn't find very much treasure. And so this myth came about of the Templar treasure, where did it go? And, you know, people are still searching for it today. And it's a bit silly because the Templar treasure was created with this banking system, with money. And it wasn't the old style of money that you were referring to with the bartering and gold being the only type of, or gold or silver being the only type of money that was used. The Templars introduced this new idea that money is what you believe it is. In other words, if this piece of paper says it's worth $100 and someone accepts it, then it is $100, whether there's gold backing it or not. And that's what our modern system of money is now. We use fiat currency. We use money that's not backed by anything. It's just what it is. Whatever we accept it as, whatever it can buy, is what its value is. And the Templars really responsible for creating that idea of money. And if it hadn't been for that, if such a monetary system hadn't been created, we would still be bartering, and you know, money would only be worth the amount of gold or silver that the coin had in it, you know. And the thing is that doesn't allow any sort of growth, any sort of financial expansion. But if you can loan someone money and then receive money back with interest, then you've grown the money supply. And that wasn't possible with the previous methods of exchanging money, but when paper money was created and checking and banking, then you could do that. And so that's really responsible for the Industrial Revolution, all the economic changes that occurred after feudalism, eventually creating modern capitalism. All this came from the innovations that the Templars initiated. And then, yes, Freemasons were responsible for sort of...
Are you taking any call-ins?
Oh, yes. I was going to announce the third hour, but we're...
Oh, okay. So you want to wait till the third hour?
No, we can take calls now. The number's 888-268-4313.
Okay.
If you want to call in. Do you have a caller on the line?
Yes, we do. I can put them on.
All right, go ahead.
You got it.
Yes, caller, what's your first name and where are you calling from?
This is Kyle. I'm calling from Joliet, Illinois.
I can't hear them at all.
I got Keith something. Illinois.
Hold on, I'll get him up here.
Quiet.
From Joliet, Illinois. I'm calling from the cell phone. It must be why it's not doing so great. Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. I'll try to relay your question.
I must be a little off topic because I have been listening for a few minutes, but I have a question. Do any of you know why the secrecy is still played up on the Masons, even though it's available to be, they're available to be learned about almost anywhere, online or bookstores?
Well, that's a pretty good question, and I think it kind of goes to jealousy or rage against the, quote, establishment, that people try to think that there is some secrecy or some secret society like Illuminati or Secret Grove people or whatever, that some small group of men is secretly pulling the strings all around the world to manipulate wars and banks and values. And I can tell you that it operates mostly like chaos, and I think that most of that is just conspiracy theory. I'm with you. All of this is available to be learned. The results of it, the machinations of it are easy to learn, easy to master. I don't see the darkness and the evil that some conspiracy people see in it, although I'm certain in some instances it exists, but I don't think on a global basis.
No, I didn't hear everything he said, but I think, you know, the Freemasonry is a secret society because they have rituals in secret. They have passwords and mysteries that they learn in the lodge that they're not supposed to tell other people. But yes, you're right. The books are in the library, they're at the bookstore, anyone can read them. So the mysteries and secrets of Freemasonry aren't that secret anymore, but it's still a secret society. In fact, you know, I'm able to talk openly about Freemasonry because I'm not a Mason, but if I was, I wouldn't be able to talk about it because I would have taken an oath not to reveal the secrets, even though they're still in the books and they're available.
But along with that line, you know, there are, have been copies of economic systems. Certainly coinage is not unique to Freemasonry. However, the system set up by the Templars is the only one that has actually functioned. Because one of the things that's crucial, critical, it's vital, is that people have to have faith in that system, or it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Paper money really is not worth the paper that it's written on. But the faith behind it is what's important. And somehow the Templars had the pattern. They had the symbolism, the ancientness, the perfectness of the system, so that the Federal Reserve could create wealth out of thin air and allow the economy to grow, allow people to borrow money to buy homes. Actually, their local bank borrows the money from the Federal Reserve, marks it up a little bit, reloans it to us, and we pay it to Lowe's for our home building supplies or Home Depot, and that's how the system works.
Mm-hmm.
Without that faith, the whole system collapses. And so there is something magical, and there is something almost supernatural about the system that the Freemasons or that the Templars put together. And that's what we're going to try and figure out, or at least talk about a little bit in our third hour, as we talk about the dollar as opposed to yen or pesos or rubles. Or, you know, we've seen lots of currencies go by the wayside because people and other nations just simply didn't have faith in it.
Mm-hmm.
We have a problem like that right now on our planet from Chinese currency. Its value is quite artificial, and it's not allowed to float with market forces, and it is causing a big problem. We're paying for it at the pumps right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope we answered your question.
Oh, thoroughly. Thank you for having me on the air.
How are you listening?
I'm actually on my cellular phone right now.
Excellent.
I was listening to on the website for a while.
Okay.
Perfect. All right. Well, we just want to know. Sometimes we pick up AM affiliates, and we want to recognize them. So thank you for your call.
All good luck. God be with you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. All right. I could finally hear that at the end. Don finally got the volume up, and it sounded pretty good. For a cell phone call, I was impressed. So anyway, I think I'm getting the picture now. Somehow... And you know, when you think about banking systems, oh my goodness, when I took classes for my master's in accounting, I barely learned it. And to invent that out of whole cloth, how economics works, to have the former Alan Greenspan's job to try to figure out how to set interest rates to keep everything moving forward. And literally, you're setting the interest rates for the whole world because everything is gauged from that one announcement. It's a tremendous balancing act, and it's almost, I'm not going to say clairvoyant, but it seems to be, and you'll have to pardon me for using this word, it's almost spiritual how they know what to do to keep the world trading with one another. Because obviously, if the economic system breaks down, we're in big trouble.
Well, yeah, it is spiritual. They do. They play the role of a priest almost. They have to create this aura of truth to the money. They have to make people believe that the money has value, and they also have to make people believe that what they're doing when they change the interest rates and other things that they control. They have to make people believe that they're doing that for the overall good, that it will result in overall good. And so far, the Federal Reserve has been amazingly capable of creating that sort of faith. And actually, you're not very far off the mark at all, because there was an economist who wrote a book called Secrets of the Temple in the 80s, and the temple was all about the Federal Reserve. He was referring to the Federal Reserve as a temple, and its chairman as sorcerers, basically conjuring money out of thin air and using their sort of psychic abilities to decide what's the best way to manipulate that money. And so, yes, there's definitely magic in place in the workings of the American economy. It's been that way since the beginning. We've always had money that was essentially fiat currency that wasn't really backed up 100% by by gold or silver. But the modern $1 bill that we have now is really a magical talisman. It's full of magical symbols, and all of these symbols work together to create a message about having faith in the dollar, that the United States is under the divine providence of God, and God approves of the United States, and by extension, the dollar. And it communicates this idea of fecundity and wealth and unity or oneness amongst the population. I can go into detail there if you want.
Oh, yeah,
about
we're
going
to go into a lot of detail on it in the next hour. Okay. Where did the word dollar come from?
It's actually a German word. There was a coin called the Thaler there in Germany that was widely used there. They also used them in Scotland. The word Thaler kind of just was used all over Europe in different places to refer to a silver coin. And actually the first Thalers were minted by an alchemist, a guy named Georgius Agricola, minted the first dollars, silver dollars, and he gave up alchemy when he started doing that because he said, making dollars is essentially the same thing as alchemy. I've achieved my result here by doing this, and so I don't need to fiddle with alchemy anymore.
Now alchemy is the ancient sort of black art, I guess, if it could ever be done, of converting base metals into valuable metals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a way of instant wealth, kind of like winning the lottery through a magician.
Right.
And I guess we've kind of done that, haven't we?
Yeah, that's the premise of my book, is that essentially is what the modern banking system does. It takes paper or nothing, or cheap pieces of metal, and turns them into something valuable that can be traded for something you really want. And in alchemy, there's this concept, the thing that transforms gold, lead into gold, is this thing called the universal agent. And it's also referred to as the philosopher's stone. It's this thing that can't really be described, but it's the thing that can change any one thing into any other thing in the alchemical process. And to me, that's what money does now. American dollars, that you can spend them, and there's pretty much no situation you can get yourself into that money can't get you out of if you have enough. And there's nothing that you can't change if you have enough money. So I think that the money now is very much like the universal agent. And the fact that money is intrinsically valueless unless you're using it to buy something, that makes the money itself very much like the alchemical gold. Creating the money via the banking system is very much like the process of alchemy. And I don't know, I'm not saying that is what alchemy is, that no one ever did any real alchemy, but it's analogous. It's the same thing. It's the same concept.
I think so. I think exactly right. And maybe that was the original intent in the first place, and that possibly early greedy men who really couldn't master the total concept of the magic of economy,
mm-hmm,
thought that maybe that's what it means. I can take this ordinary lead or bronze and I can make it into gold. And they didn't understand. No, it's actually a process,
mm-hmm,
that requires the faith of the people in order to function.
You know, what's interesting is this was actually the plot of the play Faust. Johann von Goethe, who's a Freemason, wrote this, and one of the plot lines in it is that the main character contacts the devil, and the devil gives him all this insight. That's basically what the main character wants. He wants ultimate knowledge from the devil, and so he's learning these various pieces of wisdom from him on a daily basis. And one of the things that he learns is how to manipulate the local economy there. He teaches the emperor how to print paper money in order to create instant wealth, and it's referred to as alchemy in the play. And so it's kind of interesting that even back then, people perceived the printing of paper money as alchemy. Of course, there's a sort of a moral to that story, where of course it's the devil who creates the paper money, and in the end, in the story, the paper money becomes worthless, and the economy collapses. So, I mean, it's like anything that's magical. Your belief makes it real, but also if something, because it's magical, because it's ethereal, something can come along and burst that bubble at any time, and then it disintegrates into nothingness again. And that's something that, you know, everyone's afraid of happening to the American economy. It could happen, but that's no reason to go back to using gold and silver.
Yes, and I see the extension of it now because, I mean, look at our population, look at how far and wide dollars get spent. It costs a lot of money to print it. It costs a lot to maintain it, to keep it from being counterfeited. It's obviously not traceable, so you can trade it for drugs or armies or whatever you want to trade it for. So it's quickly becoming a liability because it is so easily exchanged. And now I see efforts by more than one government working together to create a unified money system, or maybe even worse, less value than paper, ones and zeros.
Yeah.
In electronic format. I myself rarely carry cash with me. It's kind of biodegradable, but if I carry my my bank card with me, I have a good record of what I've bought and how much money I have at any given moment, and it's safe and secure, kind of like those chits that people would carry from one point to another in the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
And I can exchange it in Chicago or Japan or even here in Western Kentucky for the exact same value instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we are headed into the next level of alchemy, taking something even more worthless and exchanging it.
But, yeah, but I mean, I wonder, like, you know, if you don't have the dollar bill with its Masonic symbols on it, sort of subliminally making you believe in the power of the dollar, if you just have a credit card, I wonder if it would have the same sort of magic, you know?
Very interesting, and we will cover that in depth in our third hour. We will take about a three-minute commercial break here, so if our guest would like to take another break, she can do that. Our guest is Tracy Twyman. This is X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Well, now the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor for a Boy Scout or an Eagle Scout. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home or a friend. This is a high-quality plaque. It can add something very special. It lets people know how excited you are that we are returning to the moon. Soon, men and women will be walking on the moon again. We're looking at 2018, or maybe sooner than that. But if you want this plaque, you need to go to Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio. That's at x2-radio.com and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. You own an inkjet printer, right? Well, I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store that will remain unnamed for about $35 per cartridge. The color and black cartridges together with tax ran about $80. Well, no more. I discovered a place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjet. They not only provide excellent quality and fast shipping. This month is April, and they're giving away 5 free printers a day. So each purchase that you make, you not only get a cheap price on a excellent print cartridge, you may win a printer. But stop paying those high prices and visit 123 Inkjet at X Squared Radio today and start saving money. I like wildlife. And I don't like wild animals running around the inside of my house, but I like the art. And I want to tell you about a store called Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles. I like to collect the eagles. To horses, elephants, and all sizes and price ranges. Great looking stuff. No matter what animal you love most, they have the art for you and all kinds of carvings out of wood and ceramic. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for your special someone today. And there is some place you should visit before the end of next week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase. It will actually be delivered in May, but you can get $5 off if you order it now. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, this may be one of the most important purchases you ever make. So click on The Horizon Project at thehorizonproject.com, or you can click on the banner at X Squared Radio today. You know, we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We provided you lots of data that that is actually occurring. And we might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people, like things for the outdoors or maybe their meditation garden. But you can get a barometer or a digital thermometer or a GPS, all kinds of neat stuff at Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. And we will take about a 43-second musical interlude and be back with our guest, Tracy Twyman. This is X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest this afternoon is Tracy Twyman, author of a fantastic book called Solomon's Treasure. You can pick it up by going to Amazon.com or by going to her website, and you can tell us that website again. I'd appreciate it.
It's DragonKeyPress.com. And as a special for your listeners, anyone who purchases something from our website in the next few days will receive a free copy of the magazine we used to publish called Dagobert's Revenge. And so that's $6 that you don't have to spend to get Dagobert's Revenge.
And I also have a copy of that magazine, and it is almost a book by itself.
Yeah.
Man, tremendous amount of stuff in this.
Yeah, very few advertisements, lots of just in-depth articles about not only Freemasonry, but bloodlines, other secret societies, other cryptological things that I'm sure your listeners would be very interested in.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about the American monetary system. I think it's the world standard. Everything is kind of gauged off the dollar, the almighty greenback. And it kind of started out that way. I mean, we had a couple of errant states and tried to print their own money, different kinds of script, and we print other kinds of money in this country right now. We call it stock.
Yeah.
Bearer bonds can be traded just as easily as money is traded, although I don't own any. They do have value. I don't know anybody that doesn't have a little bit of money in some kind of stock or mutual fund. That's its own form of currency, too. And this country, we sell our debt. Other nations buy bonds which finance the debt of the United States of America, and they own that debt, and we make payments on that debt until it's paid off, like it's ever going to be paid off. But there is, as you mentioned earlier, some mysticism, some magic about especially the $1 bill. Tell us, you got all the time in the world now, we're in our third hour, you can tell us about all the symbols that are on the $1 bill.
Okay, well, it's important to note that the $1 bill new design was issued in 1935, around the same time that the dollar was finally going completely off of the gold standard. So it's interesting to note that the dollar bill was designed with all of its symbols that, as I said before, are meant to create a sense of faith in the currency. This happened at the same time that the gold standard, which had previously been used to create sense of faith in the currency, was being removed. So you don't have the gold standard backing anymore. You need more faith. And that's what they did when they redesigned the dollar bill. They created a magical talisman that would make people have faith in the dollar and faith in their country that it would continue into the future, and so that they could go ahead and spend money now with confidence that they would be able to earn money in the future. And so the people that designed the $1 bill, it's a group, all of them were Freemasons, and three very famous people: President Franklin Roosevelt himself, then his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, and Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, all got together to design the $1 bill. And I treat the $1 bill specifically because that's the unit of currency upon which the whole currency is based. You know, when we think of the dollar, we think of the $1 bill. And that's the bill that they chose to put all of this symbolism on.
Sure. When we think about the metric system, we think about the meter. So mm-hmm. The dollar is kind of the meter for dollars. But didn't George Washington contribute to some of the symbolism on that bill?
Well, it's dominated by these two roundels that are they're the front and back of the Great Seal of the United States. And yeah, that was created in 1776. It was Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin had a lot of influence on the design of the Great Seal, which the design has varied a little bit over the years. So the version that we have on the back of the dollar bill now was kind of finalized at that point when they created the dollar bill. But Freemasons had previously been responsible for designing the Great Seal of the United States, and so that's why it has Masonic symbols on it, like the all-seeing eye over the pyramid. And the interesting thing is that the Great Seal, it has this front and back, right? Well, the pyramid is actually the back of the seal. And the eagle with the E Pluribus Unum in his mouth, that was the front of the seal. And that's what they've always used to seal official U.S. documents.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the die for the back of the seal wasn't even cut at the time. They cut the die for the front of the seal, but they completely forgot about, or supposedly forgot about, the back of the seal, and that wasn't even created for like another 100 years.
Wow.
And so, like, really no one even knew that the Great Seal of the United States had a back to it until the dollar came out, because no one really had seen it before. And so, another interesting thing is that they're in reverse order on the back of the dollar. You would think that the front of the seal would be on the left, and then the back would be on the right, because you read left to right, but... And in fact, that's the way it was originally designed, and the design was presented to President Roosevelt, and he said that it should be the other way around because the pyramid is more interesting, and so your eye naturally goes to the left, so he switched them around.
Was Roosevelt a Mason?
Yes, he was a 33rd degree Freemason, and so was Henry Wallace. I'm not sure about, I know Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, who helped to design it, was a Freemason. I'm not sure what his rank was, but, you know, they were all Freemasons, and they all were using the same sort of magic that you use in Masonic rituals. They were using that when they decided to design this bill. And there's so many things going on this bill. And one of the things is the number 13, that is one of the most repeated symbols on the bill. And, of course, number 13 has always been important to America because we had 13 colonies, and originally 13 stars and stripes, and you know, so everyone just says, well, that's why the 13 is important, because of the 13 colonies. But, you know, you got to wonder why were there 13 colonies?
Oh, it had to go back before that.
It does. I mean, it is not particularly a Masonic symbol, or at least you can't find it in Masonic encyclopedias and stuff. But it was important to the Templars, and in alchemy, there's supposedly 13 stages to it. And so the number of 13 is definitely important, and they put it all over the place. Yeah, I think the alchemical explanation is most important, actually, because it's like the number 12 represents completion. You know, like there's 12 tribes of Israel, or 12 disciples for Jesus. But there's always, like with Jesus and his 12 disciples, Jesus is the 13th element there. That's the element that transforms the whole into something new. And that's where the idea of 13 ties in with alchemy. It's like this number of transformation, of one step beyond. And so we find this all over the $1 bill. Just a few examples. There's more than I can list. But the pyramid on the left has 13 layers, not including the eye at the top. And then above the head of the eagle on the right, there's a constellation of 13 stars. There's 13 leaves on the olive branch in his left talon.
And the stars, are they in a particular pattern themselves?
Yes, they're arranged in a seal of Solomon, a six-pointed star.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's 13 arrows in the eagle's right hand. There's 13 horizontal divisions on the eagle's shield and 13 vertical ones. The motto E Pluribus Unum, written on the banner in his beak, has 13 letters. So does the motto Annuit Coeptus, which is written above the pyramid on the left.
So what does that mean?
It means, basically the translation is, God agrees with the cause we have started. And that the God is sort of kind of implied. It really says he agrees. It comes from a poem from Virgil, for the Roman poet. And in the original poem, it referred to omnipotent Jupiter and asked for his favor over the daring undertaking of the character in the Virgil poem. And so it's like, when you see that quote on the dollar bill without the context of the Virgil poem, you still have to kind of assume that the same idea was implied. Virgil was talking to Jupiter, the omnipotent god, and Jupiter is basically the same as Jove or Jehovah, our omnipotent god. And so I think that's what the founders were saying when they put that on the Great Seal. They were saying God approves of our daring undertaking, which is the creation of the United States, something that had never been done before. And so, yeah, it's like, again, just like the eye over the pyramid, it's saying there's divine providence at work here, that we operate under God. And so that gives, it's another one of the things that gives the dollar bill some of its magic or spiritual power.
Well, I know some people that I've heard talk about this say, well, the reason they put all this symbolism in there is because men were trying to be God. They were trying to be like God. But that's really not what I got out of the men that were behind this, that literally sacrificed their lives and even their children's lives for this nation, that they were actually pretty selfless individuals. And when they said in God we trust, and they put, I guess, that on the hard currency, but I think that was years and years later, it was not that, you know, God empowers us, it's that God ordains what we are trying to do here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Freemasons believed that they were fulfilling the plan of the ancients, something that had been passed down to their forefathers, a charge that had been given to them by the divine presence. So definitely, and they had nothing to gain. I mean, if you think back to the revolutionary time period when people had, an average lifespan of 40, you know, there's no way that they would have personally gained by creating some sort of conspiracy that will eventually take over the world, you know? I mean, they were it was definitely a daring undertaking because they didn't know whether they were going to succeed or not. And if they didn't succeed, they were all going to be killed for committing treason. So.
And they all were anyway. They
yeah.
all died penniless and they had their stuff taken from them and most of them died violently. So you're exactly right. All 56 signers, ended up with a terrible demise. But the interesting thing is that, you know, international banking, international trading, it's been tried, like you said, all the way back to the Crusades with very limited success. Do you think that the New Jerusalem had to be established, had to be separated from crowns and royalties and all of that trappings, a government by the people and for the people, in order for this international banking system to finally succeed?
Yeah, it definitely had to be separated from any of the powers in Europe. You know, I was telling you about the Templars and how as soon as they got indebted to the King of France, his immediate instinct was to just take their money and cancel the debt. And that's what would have happened anywhere in Europe if someone had tried to create a monetary system like this. The reason why European economies were so unstable at that time was because the king was always choosing to spend money on some personal project or himself, and he would just print more money, have the mint more money, and it's like the king was in charge of the monetary system, but obviously had no real understanding of economics. And so, yes, it was very important to have a place across the ocean with a completely independent government that no one could touch, that wasn't, you know, no one individual could control and use to his own ends in order for the experiment to work. And they've been successful so far in maintaining that. I mean, I don't think Freemasons are in control of the United States anymore, but the plan that they enacted was so perfect that it's still continuing on.
Yeah, I never really looked at it as though they controlled the United States. I kind of looked at it as though they preserved and brought forward the tools it would take to empower the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of like they kept it secret and sacred as long as they could, and then they brought it to the one country, to New Jerusalem, where they could establish their ancient design of economics. And, you know, as we discussed before, this may have origins off this planet. It is so perfect in its design, but, of course, it can be corrupted. And one of the things I want to talk about is the Federal Reserve. You know, somehow, I guess many of the early presidents and early politicians tried to establish a national bank. And it was resisted for a long time. And, in fact, we really haven't had effective interstate banking in this country until just very recently. We've had some. I am living in Kentucky and bank with a different bank than my co-author who lives in Tennessee. It's difficult to move funds back and forth, so it's not perfect. But the Federal Reserve isn't really a bank, is it?
Well, it is, but I mean, I as an individual can't open up an account there. It's a bank that provides money to other banks. It's the point of origin for all of the money in the American economy. And the money that they loan out to the first banks that they give it to, that's called high-powered money because that's the seed, the mustard seed upon which all the other money in the economy comes from. They eject this money into the economy. They loan it to these banks, and they determine the interest rate that they'll loan it at, and then that determines what those banks will loan their money out at. And so they're the bank that creates the banking system for the rest of the banks. And it started in 1913 after just the whole history of the United States was history of banking collapses up until that point. I mean, we had Continentals that financed the Revolutionary War, and we had greenbacks that financed the Civil War, and those were paper currencies. But they were short-lived, and those were both issued by the government, the federal government, but there were other currencies circulating up until 1913 that were issued by private banks. And sometimes there were different bills floating around depending on what state you were in or even what bank you went to. And there was nothing uniform about the way all these banks did business. And so, you know, you could one day just wake up and find out there had been a banking panic and everyone had withdrawn their money from the bank before you got a chance to go back down there, and there was no money left. The bank collapsed, and you were screwed.
And in fact, 16 years later, it did do that in 1929.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yes, the creation of the Federal Reserve didn't prevent all banking collapses. That's true. But pretty much it's been stable ever since, well, ever since the 30s when Roosevelt issued the new dollar bill. So yeah, the Federal Reserve has created a kind of stability in our economy that we never had before. And it does act as this sort of the temple where the priests conjure up the money and then they give it to the rest of the world. And it's like a lot of other banks in other countries, too, have now copied the system of the Federal Reserve, and it's working out pretty well for them, too. So it's really the best thing that's ever happened to our economy. And so I wouldn't say that it was a mistake at all. But, you know, some people are worried about, you know, what if the economy collapses, because it's all dependent upon the Federal Reserve and it's all dependent on people having faith in the money. And, you know, that I suppose that could happen at some point. Everything comes to an end eventually. But right now, you know, we wouldn't want our economy to function any other way.
Yeah, I think about, you know, the U.S. economy, and it's pretty much stable. And I can trade whether I'm in Kentucky or California or New York pretty much the same way. I may have to change it into a different currency to go to Europe or to go to Mexico or Canada. But largely it's pretty stable because of the Federal Reserve. People watch what the Federal Reserve does, and they gauge their economies on that if their currencies are allowed to float with market forces. Now, some governments are artificially manipulating their currencies in order to make it easier for them to make foreign investment or for other countries to make investments in their country, and I see where that's having its effect. We have a terrible trade imbalance in this country, and eventually we'll end up paying for it. But besides the magic of the dollar bill establishing faith of the people in the currency, I mean, I really believe that the dollars that I have on my table will be worth the same amount tomorrow somewhat. But what made the banking stable was that they invented the FDIC, which really requires a lot of faith, too, because we haven't had a banking failure. We have had a savings and loan failure, but we haven't had a across-the-board banking failure since the FDIC was put in place. And
right.
I finally read it one time, what it really means. And it only insures your money up to $100,000.
Yeah.
And then they have 10 years to pay it back to you. It's not like you can go to the bank and get $100,000 out. Or that you should spread your $100,000 or your $1 million out to 10 different banks so you can get it all back. They can actually keep it and pay you little bits of it over a 10-year period.
Well, but isn't it true that most banks won't even let you have an account of over $100,000 because of that?
No, that's not true.
I guess maybe you would know.
I have friends that have more money than that in a local hometown bank, and of course they're shareholders in that bank as well, so they have an investment. But it's not uncommon for them to have $500,000 in that bank for 6 months at a time to provide a trigger instrument for other lending. The bank will encumber that money for a period of time in the form of a certificate of deposit so that it triggers other capital, which is obviously a problem in our society today, is, I guess, the same problem that they've always had, and that's access to capital.
Mm-hmm.
The wealthy have always had access to capital, and I don't mean just rich people. I mean wealthy people. But middle class having access to capital is a pretty recent thing.
Yeah.
Maybe since the early 50s, the
credit
middle
cards,
class.
Yeah,
well, not just credit cards, but being able to, say, go to the Small Business Administration or borrow money to to buy a factory and start up, hire 10 people and form a company.
Mm-hmm.
Middle class people for about 40 or 50 years have had fairly decent access to capital. And there are lots of laws put in place to make sure that banks serve the lending needs of their community, but there is still some discrimination that goes on with that. I think you'll have a lot better luck as a second-generation borrower than you will as a move-in going down to the local bank and borrowing $500,000 to start a new company.
Mm-hmm.
So access to capital is still somewhat restricted, but now I think the function of this whole idea of one world government, one world monetary system, is the idea of the Federal Reserve now has to expand. It has to go, for instance, we have a real problem with our closest neighbor, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have stable banking. They don't have stable insurance. And so consequently, life on our side of the river is much better than life on their side of the river, although we vacation there every chance we get. And it's simply because they just don't have the faith behind their monetary system. So the Federal Reserve has got to expand its model, or should I go a little further in line with our program and say, Templars, the Freemasons, the Masons need to expand their model and start encompassing some of these, and I won't call them third world countries, but lesser developed countries, certainly lots of potential.
Well, I think it's really the missing part for countries south of the border is that the governments there aren't stable themselves, so there's no way that they could ever create a stable economy that where people had faith in the currency, because no one has faith in the government itself. And I've heard stories where, you know, when a country like Argentina is in political free fall, that, you know, if you get paid on Friday, you run down to the bank when you have like a shoebox full of paper notes because the economy, the money is so inflated, and you run down to the bank because every minute that's ticking by, that money is getting more and more worthless. So you want to get credited with it right away. And you know, it's just insane.
I actually was involved in I was working in Mexico, and for a brief period, I think about 90 days, they were suffering 1,500% inflation. And, well, you know how you go to the bank and you borrow the money to buy a car, and you have a fixed car payment until it's paid off. It's not that way in Mexico. If it changes, if the inflation changes, your car payment changes. And so people were going down to the dealerships and just literally dumping their keys on the counter, saying, I'm done. I can't pay for it anymore. So if that happens wholesale, then your whole system of government falls apart. And now, at least in the not-too-distant past, we formed the International Monetary Fund, which is kind of a slush of raw equity that we could move into smaller economies to shore them up, to prevent runaway inflation or, worse, recession when there's, you know, not enough money in the system. And to provide access to capital for governments to take care of serious flaws in their economy, and that has helped. It has helped a lot divert things. I know we've loaned out of that fund to Mexico, and they've paid it back, and it's been a pretty nice tool. But now it sounds like if nations lose confidence or faith in the instrument that was valuable, the whole system would collapse. And I was going to ask you if that's ever happened before, but we've certainly talked about kingdoms and dynasties that, a good example would be this. If a man owned a business, and each day he walked into the business, he told his employees, the first $200 in that cash drawer is mine. And he did that every day. That drain from his income or from the revenue of his business would eventually drive him out of business. And that's kind of what kings do. And when they have access to the treasury, is they say, you know, the first 2 tons of gold that go in there are mine. I'm going on safari with my harem.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, he's drained all the value out of his country. We just went through that with Enron, did we not?
Yeah, it happens in private companies, certainly.
Because they're printing money called stock.
Yeah.
And when people lose faith in it, it crashes. But,
yeah, And I think, you know, it's not happening in the United States, but that's still happening in other countries all over the place, all the time. That, you know, the politicians who are in charge of the monetary system are just using it to divert funds to themselves and their friends.
And in your opinion, since you've done all this research, and I'm going back through your book again, and there's many other interesting things about the symbolism, the deities behind the formation of value and management of value. Do you think it's possible that a regional or a national or even global crash could occur again?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm bothered all the time when I see what the dollar's value is in relation to other currencies these days, especially the pound, the euro. It's it does seem to be getting, you know, we're skating on thin ice here, and you know, and it's sad that not a lot of people do have faith in our government anymore. There's a lot of just sort of self-loathing amongst the American population now. Everyone wants to believe that everything America does is wrong. They have nothing nice to say about the president, and you know, that could be right or wrong. I'm not making a value judgment on the president, but I am saying that, you know, we as a culture, we tend to just cut people down now if they're in power. We just have a really negative attitude about our own country, our own economy, too. It's like everyone just instinctively wants to think that the economy here is bad. Well, you know, experience what it's like in Mexico or some other hellhole, and, you know, you're going to know pretty soon that it's really nice here compared to a lot of other places. But I think that's a real problem, that the American spirit is not as strong as it used to be. That we've been bombarded with negative propaganda about ourselves for so long that we have a negative attitude about ourselves now, and that's not very good for the economy, for the country as a whole, and that itself, I think, could lead to a collapse more than anything. Just another generation of people who don't have any understanding of America's history and who don't have any appreciation of it, and, you know, everything could go down the tubes. So,
I
hope not.
Unfortunately, our American political arena has not become one of ideas. It's become one of we want the party out of power wants to be in power,
mm-hmm.
and if they can't, you know, come up with better ideas than the party that's in power, then the only thing that they know to do is to publish negativity to try to tear down the one that is in power. And unfortunately, for the last 12 years, that's been going on almost nonstop. And it is almost like the party that is out of power wants back in the White House so badly that they would literally destroy the nation. In fact, destruction of the nation would probably be the only way they could get back in the White House. And so they plan for it, and it's as if it's already happened to them. And I'm not so sure that it's a Republican or Democrat thing, because I just don't think it is. I think there are leadership factions that are in charge of the party that's out of power right now that have, in my opinion, the wrong tactics.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of shortcomings with our present administration, and to come up with better ideas to replace those would certainly be wonderful for everybody. That's what competition's all about. But for one grocery store to try to better its business by telling everyone the other grocery store sells rotten food isn't what the free economy is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You come up with, you know, fresher cabbage or better corn or you know, less expensive milk, something to attract people to your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it fits so closely with this idea of perfect ratios and perfect design of economics and money. If it's perfect, then there's not a better idea that you can come up with. And so to get negative and try to tear it down to be the only way to compete with it seems to be exactly what's happening, especially worldwide. When I travel in Europe, I buy gasoline, and, well, last summer it was, 96 pence a gallon,
mm-hmm.
which is about $7.50 a gallon. Of course, the car gets 40 miles per gallon because it's a turbocharged diesel, which was really nice to drive. I wish we had them in this country as well for that amount of money. But still, you know, to drive for a week is going to cost you $300.
Mm-hmm.
That's very expensive, even in this country. And you know what you see in Europe? You don't see the people driving.
Right.
They ride the train, they ride the bus, they walk, they ride a bike, because they don't make enough money to support a $1,400 a month fuel cost.
Yeah,
so they don't travel. You don't see them on the roads.
I mean, you could do that in New York. You know, a lot of people take the subway, and in certain urban areas you could have people opt out and take mass transit. But, you know, people have to drive trucks across the country, and this country is huge, and we all rely on driving to get around. So
yes, we do.
So I don't think we could handle that. You know, yeah, we've got to figure something else out about the this source of our fuel and energy, definitely. And there has to be some sort of real leadership that we all believe in and, you know, put our faith in and try to contribute to and help. And I don't even know how you would start that. It's like, yeah, everyone has their own little faction that they're loyal to, and they don't like anyone else, and so they just want to cut down anyone who's not a member of their group. And it ends up just being bad for everyone. And
well, likewise, you have great ideas that come out for, say, new fuels,
mm-hmm.
but you have a macroeconomic power in place that literally owns governments that relies on oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have companies making $36 billion a quarter in raw profit above and beyond their costs who are willing to give up that empire for some upstart hydrogen producer who can mysteriously make a fuel from tap water. You're not going to let him have access to capital. You're not going to let him come into the economy. It's the same pattern that you had when you know, Philip of France was aligned with the Pope and wanted to control everything, and yet here were the Templars that were immensely wealthy, had their own system of banking, and or at least had the appearance of being immensely wealthy, certainly were able to control commerce internationally, and the only way around it was to capture them and torture them until they, in some kind of inquisition, revealed that they were worshiping something other than God, and they could be then put to death. One of the things that you saw when you went to Roslyn Chapel, if you go down into the basement, the cellar area, there's a stone against the north wall, and it has the carvings of renditions of the Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And they captured in stone the look of horror and pain on these Templars as they were you know, tortured to death for days and days and days until they uttered some word that could be construed to be idolatry or devil worship, and there it went. And you can bet you that the people that were being tortured never got to tell their side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they reported from these inquisitions, I know you mentioned in your book Baphomet, and I did a little bit of research on Baphomet, kind of the goat-headed, multi-symbolic devil or demon.
Mm-hmm.
And also cryptically can be translated to mean Sophia, which is a kind of a life-giving thing. And, oh, one of the things that's in the ceiling of the Roslyn Chapel is the Green Man.
Mm-hmm.
His head is in the middle of the multifaceted star that's right over the altar in the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And the Green Man is sort of, it's purported to be the source of the wealth of the Freemasons, that it let their crops grow, let their money multiply, and all of that. But he also is representative of a offspring of Nephilim. That's
yeah.
why he's kind of half plant and half man. And so there's tremendous amount of almost immortal wisdom that goes with that.
Well, I think there's actually a little bit of symbolism of the Green Man on the dollar bill. I think the Bureau of Engraving and Printing has on their website a quote from an interview from one of the treasurers at one point, and it was a quote from her interview in New Yorker magazine where she says that the reason why dollar bills are green is because green represents fecundity and wealth, and so they wanted people to get the idea of wealth when they handled the dollar, so they colored it green, and they put all this foliage all over it, like holly and if you look on the front, there's a lot of different plants and stuff on the front of the dollar bill. It's all to represent this idea of, fecundity, growth, fertility that the Green Man represented and also Baphomet represented as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that essence of the Green Man and Baphomet all is also connected to the idea of the universal agent in alchemy, sort of the source of fertility, is all wound up in the dollar bill and the symbolism that Freemasons put on it, that that's kind of at the heart of our economy, is that spiritual essence of the Green Man or Baphomet. Mm. So it all kind of everything sort of connects one way or another, I think.
I think that's it. Well, it's certainly food for conspiracy theory, but it's better than that. It's the food for the perfectness of the design, because man, if left to his own design, is going to come up with, well, we already see it.
Yeah.
Every form of government, every form of values, completely temporary, completely chaotic. You have to have a police force to enforce it. But if it's perfect, if it's true and well designed, it will support itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have cash police out there making sure that a $20 bill is worth $20. It does it because there is faith in the trueness of the system. If I work for an hour and I equally exchange my work for this talisman that I then take to the local grocery store and exchange for enough food to get by for a few days, the system works. People support it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are people that don't want to work, and yet they want the money. Or they want to do something other than work to get the money. They want to counterfeit it. They want to steal it. They want to graft it. They want to, through some machine of corruption or robbery, they want to get the money through another means. I have never understood the concept of thievery. I had a laptop stolen out of my vehicle several years back, and I was infuriated about it because I worked hard to get that laptop. It was my, it was my tool. It was my toy. And someone just smashed in my window and said, I like that laptop. And they took it, and they didn't work for it. And that's how the system doesn't work.
Yeah.
But it's
kind of amazing, though, if you think how many people don't do that. Like, how amazing it is that society does function as a whole. Most people don't go around stealing whatever they want, punching someone in the face because they don't like them. People wait at the stoplight instead of walking in front of the traffic. And it's just, people are attuned to this idea of the golden rule, that you're supposed to treat people as you would like to be treated. And people, for the most part, do that, even though they're not being forced to. And if people didn't do that, the system wouldn't work. And, that's true for the economy as well. If people didn't accept a dollar as payment for something, and if they didn't refrain from stealing or counterfeiting, then the system wouldn't work at all. So it's good that people, the vast majority of people do abide by the golden rule and play according to the rules of the system. But there's enough of them that don't, that it is a little bit of a problem. I heard that counterfeiting is a huge problem in Europe. Like 50% of the American money that's circulating in Europe has all been counterfeited.
That's absolutely true. And there are countries, governments, who sanction expert counterfeiting by the hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's very difficult to get cash into this country, into the system. We have laundering systems that detect it. And I think now you can't make a deposit over $3,000 in cash without providing identification and where did the money come from. And it's going to get worse. It'll get down to $1,000. But in European countries, it is not that difficult to, and in other countries, especially south of the border, it is not that difficult to launder American dollars through a banking system, through the Caymans, through the banks in Panama, and eventually that will wire one way or another as value through the system into a bank and become real value.
Well, yeah.
The problem is that when you insert those tens of millions of counterfeit dollars into the system, it devalues all the other dollars.
Yeah.
Because the amount of currency that's in circulation is also part of the balancing act, part of the perfection of this economic system. And that's why I mentioned earlier going to electronic money. I sincerely think that there will soon be bills placed on the floor of the House that will be called the Freedom from Cash Act or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it will accomplish, in their minds, three major things. It will get a complete control over cash businesses like drugs and terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
It will seize control of the exchange rate so that we can almost second by second balance the value from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
And it will eliminate the cost of maintaining an over-cumbersome paper supply.
Yeah.
I don't know how much a $20 bill costs to manufacture right now, but there's so much technology in that bill now, and the $100 bill especially, to keep it free from being copied by other people. And then the technology that goes into the detection systems so the local Minute Mart or local gas station can tell a real 20 from a fake 20.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's where it's going. I'm not making a prediction or anything, but I'm making a prediction that very soon there will be a bill on the House called something like the Freedom from Cash Act, and it's going to have all these wonderful benefits. And I can see everyone's ears perking up right now, because all it would take is another few ones and zeros to link that to embedded chips, and now you have no identity theft, and the whole system is put together.
But I literally don't think that that will ever happen in the United States. People will not accept an implanted chip, and it's all because of this Mark of the Beast idea. And it's like all modern because, the Mark of the Beast is in the Bible, but this modern interpretation of it, that it's going to be a chip that you use as a credit card embedded in your hand, but and the Antichrist makes you do it. That's all been fomented over the last 20 or 30 years in these Christian apocalypse movies. And it's like, it's a part of the common lore now, the mythology of America. It's, everyone knows that the Mark of the Beast is a chip in your hand that you use to pay for everything. And so it's like, I don't think that they could ever get away with that. They could have electronic money. They could make you use a debit card for everything. But they will never get people to accept an implanted chip, because everybody thinks if they take that chip that they've forfeited their soul. So no one's going to do it. That's my opinion.
I know you say that, but I have friends that are ranchers, and there is not a ranch or any kind of animal in this country, whether it be an alpaca or a cow or a horse, that does not have an embedded chip in it now.
That's true.
It is the law. And in many states, including this one right here, you cannot own a dog without an implanted chip, and they will know if that dog is neutered or spayed as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think our generation, we would say, oh, the Mark of the Beast. But one more generation, my kids would say that you look as silly protesting an embedded chip as if you came on national news and said that you saw a UFO. They would say, you know what, that old biblical thing, it is so silly, this is really good, it's going to save everybody. I've had my money stolen, my identity stolen. If I get sick and I'm in a foreign country, if I get abducted, here will be one of the selling points. And I'm not a proponent for it. I'm just saying this is how it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You let one kidnapped child be found because of an embedded chip.
Yeah.
And it will be all over the cable news 24 hours a day. And by the time that story is dead, people will be lining up their kids for
the
chip.
Okay, yeah, that's a way you could do it. Adults won't take it for themselves, but they'll put it in their children who have no idea what's happening to them. So
one more generation.
Yeah, you're right. It could happen. It's a scary thought. I wouldn't take it myself because I mainly use a debit card for everything. But, you know, there are times when you need cash, and it's really annoying to have to use a card. And then there's things like, what if you want to hire someone to babysit? You have to, like, run a credit card through a machine, you know?
You know that high-ranking military officials and government officials must receive a chip in case they're kidnapped?
Really?
That's correct.
Where'd you get that?
In this country, it's the law. If they kidnapped the vice president, they would know where he is down to 3 feet instantly.
Well,
same with generals, same with the chiefs of staff, same with people that work in the Pentagon. They all have embedded chips so that they can be found, so they cannot be compromised, taken and tortured. They can be located.
Well,
it is
coming. It's already happening.
Yes. And of course, this is not Freemasonry behind this
right.
at all. What we're trying to explain is that the perfectness of the economic system set up anciently, way, way, way before the Templars were ever formed. They received this design. They practiced it or tried to practice it for centuries, unsuccessfully because of the greed of men, it fell apart. It required the formation of a new nation, a nation that they would call New Jerusalem or New Atlantis, and it would have specific characteristics about it, of freedom and liberty to become who and what you want to be, even a talk radio host if you want to be, or the author of a book or a movie star. You can be what you want to be, and that's what this nation is all about. And I believe our guest has supported that somehow all of the conditions had to be right, the design had to be right, and the Freemasons that literally sacrificed their lives on both sides of the ocean to see it happen had paid a great price. And the price was worth it, that the idea of America, otherwise known as the New Jerusalem, I think we discussed where the name Ameriku or America came from. It's lots more ancient than Amerigo Vespucci. It's all one design, and it's, I think, perfect in its design, maybe imperfect in its implementation, because we're human. But the design is perfect, and it seems that if we have faith in it, it will continue, and I hope it does, don't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, I don't think that Freemasons are in control of things anymore. There just aren't enough people in positions of power that are Freemasons to say that. But I almost wish that they were. I mean, I wish that there was something that, you know, most of the leaders of our government were involved in that they was persuading them to have altruistic motives rather than selfish motives. And I think Freemasonry played that role up through World War II and even the Truman administration afterwards. I think that, Freemasonry had an influence on those men where they felt that they had a higher purpose than serving their party or themselves. And I think that's very lacking in modern politics. And it may be because they aren't members of secret societies. Or if they are, they're all different ones, like Skull and Bones. You know, it has a few members who try to exert some influence. But all they try to do really is just get their own people into positions of power for selfish motives, just so that they can help each other out. It has nothing to do with a higher purpose, like Freemasonry had. But I still believe that the grand plan that the founding fathers laid down, it's like they let a genie out of a bottle, and it's operating on its own, even if the leaders of our country right now aren't consciously acting out the plan. It's still spiritually, it's in effect, and that plan is orchestrating events currently and into the future.
You know, Osama bin Laden recently released another tape, and in it, he seems to always mention this, but in it, he remarked about a war between the people of Islam, Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and the Crusaders.
Right.
It always goes back to this. So I guess my final question is, if we really believe we're in the latter days, are we fighting a war between the tenets of Freemasonry and the forces of evil?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. Yeah, I think the Muslims have sort of an ancestral memory. Well, they have passed down traditions from generation to generation in a way that we haven't. And they have a memory of the Crusades that we don't have. And so they see everything that's going on now today as a continuation of the Crusades and other rivalries. In fact, you could say that the rivalry between the East and the West now really goes back to Ishmael and Isaac in the Bible, that all Muslims claim to have genetic inheritance from Ishmael. And it was Isaac's line, his brother, that the Jewish kings came from and the Jewish priesthood. And that whole bloodline came from Ishmael's brother Isaac. And so we've got, in a way, sort of a continuation of that family rivalry that's described in the Bible that has continued on, where you could say that Europe and now the United States and other Western countries are continuing the tradition. They are the inheritors of the line of Isaac, and Muslims and people in the East are continuing the traditions of the line of Ishmael, and they have always been at loggerheads with one another, and the Crusades was another manifestation of that, and then what's happening in modern times is as well. And I definitely think also, like, you know, the Muslim terrorist groups remember the Templars. They remember their own groups back during the Crusades fought the Templars, but at the same time there was a sort of understanding between the two groups. There was a respect between the two groups, and I think in a way that's still going on in a covert way today, where it's like the terrorist groups have all been, or not all of them, but some of them have been trained by American intelligence agencies in the past. And there's sort of a cooperation going on between the Western intelligence agencies and Eastern terrorist groups. I'm not saying that, you know, the United States planned 9/11, or I'm not saying any sort of conspiracy theory, but there's a continuation of the same rivalries that have gone on in ancient times and during the medieval times in the Crusades and now. And it's the Muslims seem to remember the details of the past a lot better than we do. And I think they have a better overall scope of what's actually going on in this clash of civilizations than we do. And so it's sort of, we're at a disadvantage in a way because we don't have this sort of ancient memory that they do.
Oh, you're exactly right. I don't hear people going, oh, yeah, the Crusades, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
They don't hear that in modern commentary, and they don't understand direct and violent attacks on the foundation of the economic system set up by the Templars. They counterfeit money, they do green mail, they attack our electronic commerce. In fact, when they attacked this nation using airplanes as missiles,
mm-hmm.
they didn't particularly go after military targets. They went after economic targets.
Yeah.
They wanted to take down the symbols of the success, and they wanted to take down the symbols of Freemasonry, the Pentagon, the World Trade Centers. They wanted to probably take out the White House. All the ancient symbols of Freemasonry they tried to take out.
They wanted to take away our faith in our government and ourselves. And I think they were very successful for a lot of people. So
yes.
I think that was a major strike that we're still recovering from.
Well, I hope that we're all still pulling together in the same direction. I hope that there aren't those who have such terrible political aspirations that they would actually work with and abet our enemies in order to see some weakness that they could capitalize on and seize their chance of regaining power in our government. Our guest tonight has been Tracy Twyman. These 3 hours always go so quickly. Her book is Solomon's Treasure, can be bought at DragonKeyPress.com.
Right.
Yes. And, of course, at Amazon. But if you buy it at DragonKeyPress.com, you will get a bonus issue of Dagobert's Revenge magazine, and you really want a copy of this. It's thick. It is full of information. It's a college course in itself. I've thoroughly enjoyed this interview, and I want to talk again, even if we don't interview again.
Okay. Yeah, I had fun.
Great.
Thanks.
Well, remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose every day. Remember, every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet and maybe saved the human race. And this is X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, saying peace, Earth Explorers. Good night, Tracy.
Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a bloginservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.